The focus of the world was on the White House last weekend. Leaders from across Europe came to sit across President Trump's desk and discuss the future of Ukraine. We're going to look at the consequences of that meeting and more on today's Trumpet World. President Trump met with Vladimir Putin in Alaska. Then he met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Washington with other EU and NATO leaders in attendance. And from these meetings, we're starting to get the outlines of a peace deal that he is pushing for Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine would swap some territory around to create a more stable border between the two. Ukraine would recognize Russia's control over that territory and over Crimea in some fashion. And then Ukraine would be given security guarantees, probably in the form of Western troops. All of this is very tentative. Just about every part of what I've said is debated and contested and not really agreed on in a final form by both sides. But it's the outlines that it's clear that this is what is being pushed for. Now, there are some major issues. Ukraine has fortified cities close to its front line with Russia that Russia hasn't been able to take despite these months of war. Russia wants to get those cities in a peace treaty. Ukraine is afraid that if they give them up, well, then moving beyond that frontier, conquering more of Ukraine will be easy pickings for Russia. They're afraid basically of a repeat of the Munich Agreement, where Czechoslovakia gave up its fortified border with Nazi Germany and then was easily devoured entirely once Germany reneged on its peace agreement. Then there's the Ukraine recognizing Russia's control of territory. I think it's very unlikely that Ukraine would outright recognize Russian control of Crimea or Russian control of Donetsk and some of these other provinces, certainly not in a permanent form. But there are ways around that, I think, that international lawyers can come up with, and they can find a way where Ukraine will kind of say, well, we won't fight you here, but we won't recognize that you permanently own it either, in kind of the same way that you have an armistice between North and South Korea. And then you have the security guarantees. This has been a major feature of peace negotiations until now. Ukraine wants to make sure that if they sign a peace deal with Russia, that Russia doesn't just use that as an opportunity to plan, to prepare, to build up, and then just attack them again when they're ready a few years down the road, or even a few months down the road. And for Ukraine, a piece of paper as a security guarantee won't cut it, for very obvious reasons. Britain, the United States, France, we gave Ukraine a security guarantee back in the early 90s in the form of the Budapest Memorandum, where it was black and white, and we told Ukraine, if anyone attacks you, we promise to defend you. And, you know, look where that got them. Wasn't worth the paper that it was printed on. So, understandably, they want something more robust this time. They want foreign soldiers deployed in Ukraine. And initially, President Trump this week at the weekend seemed open to having American troops be there. He's since backed away from that. He's indicated America might play a role in patrolling Ukraine's airspace. But the focus here has been on Europe. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But even that is kind of debated. Vladimir Putin, when meeting with Donald Trump for the first time, he kind of sounded open to these security guarantees. Since then, he said, well, we want Russia to have veto power as to whether any security guarantee is invoked. So in that case, Russia could invade Ukraine, and then Russia would be able to say, nope, not an invasion. It's a denazification effort or whatever it is, and then veto any foreign involvement in there. So that Russian position is quite clearly a non-starter. But then, of course, this is how negotiations work. Every side is going to make demands that the other side doesn't want to meet and then compromise on them. And they're trying to get more from the other side than they give up. So we're moving forwards with discussions along these lines. Where are they going to lead? What are we going to get out of this? What have we seen so far in the week, in the few days since we had those discussions in Washington? Well, let's go first to Jeremiah Jacques, our Asia correspondent, and Jeremiah, what are your thoughts on the future of these discussions? Is this an outline of a lasting peace in Ukraine?
The summation that you just gave there was an excellent one, just showing the various players involved here and some of the outlines of the general deal. And And I think some of the reasons why we should temper our optimism a little bit about it. And I think that notion that we should temper our optimism was reinforced a great deal on Thursday night when Russia carried out one of its largest aerial attacks on Ukraine of the whole war. And one of the sites that they struck in this attack was an American business. So altogether, Russia fired 574 drones and about 40 missiles at Ukraine during this attack. And these were not, aiming at the front lines or any kind of military targets. They were fired at residential buildings where families live and at civilian infrastructure facilities. The Russians, we've seen this for 3 years now. They will destroy anything if they feel that it will weaken the people's spirit. So that's how these kinds of aerial attacks often go. But this time, they also struck this U.S. factory in Mukachevo, which is far in the west of Ukraine, hundreds of miles away from the front lines. And the Russians actually hit the factory not with one cruise missile, but two. Now, this American factory, it was owned by Flex Ltd. That's a NASDAQ-listed company that's headquartered in Texas. The company makes game consoles and controllers and medical devices and things like that. And the strike on this US factory ended up starting a big fire. There were 600 workers in the factory at this time during the night shift, and 15 of those workers were injured as a result of the missile strike there. So a lot of analysts have been very taken aback by this. Since there were multiple cruise missiles that hit it, it's very difficult for the Russians to claim that it was just an accident. And of course, it comes just days after the big meeting that you were talking about there between President Trump and President Putin in Alaska. That's when we saw US soldiers on their hands and knees rolling out literal red carpet for Putin to walk on. That's when we saw President Trump giddy, literally clapping for President Putin. Many Americans were very uneasy with the optics of all of that, just in light of Putin's character and his actions over the years. But that, of course, was part of these very concerted efforts that President Trump has been making to reach some sort of a peace agreement. And this attack on Thursday, I think, casts a big pall over all of that. And it has onlookers wondering if there could be any explanation other than a deliberate attempt by Putin to humiliate President Trump. So it seems that the Russians are carrying on with the war as usual, even while they say that they're interested in peace talks. And actually, they're even ramping their attacks up. And once again, these are attacks on civilians. These are not military attacks. And so, of course, this also raises big questions about the mineral deal that President Trump made with Ukraine back in April. That agreement set up a joint reconstruction investment fund between the US and Ukraine. And the White House touted that as a guarantee of Ukrainian security because with US facilities there operating to extract and refine these various minerals, they said this meant Russia would never ever dream of attacking American investments and American facilities in Ukraine. But here we are with this direct strike by Russian cruise missiles on an American factory in Western Ukraine, and all of that never ever talk starts to sound very hollow. And then, of course, on top of this missile strike, we also had the Russians yesterday. What you mentioned at the beginning there, just saying that they and the Chinese need to be on the list of countries that will decide whether or not in the future Ukraine has or has not been attacked, and whether or not it would be okay for other nations to be involved with their defense. So it's so ludicrous. That notion is so ludicrous, especially in light of, as you said, the Budapest Memorandum. Russia has already been a signatory to Ukraine's peace in the past, and they flagrantly violated that. So it's so silly and ludicrous that this very well may be an attempt by Russia to just torpedo the whole plan. It's hard to think of any other explanation for that. But as you said, these are negotiations, and this is just one phase, and it may not be where where we end up. So it's definitely too soon to know how all this will end up. But between Russia's missile strike on a U.S. factory and its insistence that Russia will have veto power over any future peace efforts in Ukraine, a lot of analysts are growing less optimistic about the peace negotiations that President Trump has been trying to make. And it brings to mind an article that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote back in April. The article is called "Does Donald Trump Know the Way to Peace?" And one part of it says, "Peace is a noble goal, but if it is pursued the wrong way, that effort ends up achieving the opposite. Putin is an evil, ruthless, vindictive agent with Soviet-style methods of psychological warfare, assassination, and war. He has disgusting and devastating policies that are sick to the core and even satanic. Trump believes he can negotiate with Putin, giving him sections of Ukraine and expecting this to pacify him. That reveals a total lack of comprehension of the man he is dealing with. Can God get along with the devil?" End quote. So, quite a weighty statement there from Mr. Fleury's April 2025 article called "Does Donald Trump Know the Way to Peace?" And this article is a very powerful one that goes through the details of exactly who President Putin is in Bible prophecy. And it shows that there's very little cause for optimism when it comes to negotiations with this man for peace. So if anyone would like to better understand any of that, I hope that you will check out that article, "Does Donald Trump Know the Way to Peace?"
Yeah, that is a great article in this context. And I think this points to a fundamental truth that God is using these events to teach all of us. He's teaching mankind, and he's teaching America in particular and Britain, about how much we need him. And we are dealing with some very evil leaders. We're going to talk to Mihailo later about dealing with Hamas. And again, this is something that we need God and the mind of God even to deal with. But another article Mr. Fleury had talked about this, less direct than the one you mentioned, world leaders who no longer have a human mind, where he talked about in this end times you would have these leaders that have the heart of a beast. He said their minds and their passions were fixed on world conquest. It bothered them not at all to oppress and even kill millions of people in pursuit of that goal. And he's talking about, certain prophesied leaders, and Vladimir Putin meets that characteristic. And he said, "These men who became so brutal simply gave themselves over to an evil spirit. Such beastly thinking is inspired by Satan the devil." And he gave the example of Neville Chamberlain sitting down and talking to Adolf Hitler. And he said, "When we're dealing with such minds and fail to recognize it, that is deadly dangerous. Diplomacy does not work with such a man. He no longer has a man's mind." And I do think we've seen some savvy deal making from President Trump. I mean, Mihailo and I were talking about that on last week's show with this Azerbaijan-Armenia deal, where I think there's a certain brilliance there. And then, as Mihailo went on to point out, yeah, okay, there may be a certain brilliance, but it's still paving the way for America to be betrayed by Turkey. Like, if we're not getting God's input, it doesn't matter if there's human brilliance there. And in this particular case, I think President Trump does have a long track record of underestimating these beastly human leaders and the way that the approach with the negotiations with Hamas, the approach with the negotiations of Vladimir Putin. I mean, it's dangerous. And he has said, "I can solve anything." He said that when he was talking, where he's offering to mediate between India and Pakistan. And like, that is the opposite of the lesson that he and all of America needs to get. And none of this is to, like, this is not targeted really at Donald Trump. Like, any human leader that gets up there and says, "I can solve anything, I can bring about peace," they're wrong. They can't, if it's me up there saying, "I can solve anything, I can, like, just put me in charge and I'll bring peace to all these situations," and I'm doing that relying on myself, that is dangerous. And there are plenty of other leaders that have had that approach, and perhaps even more arrogantly and blatantly than President Trump has. But in well, in 2000, January 2001, when Mr. Fleury was forecasting a second Trump term, he said, "We must all realize that no politician can save America. The Republicans cannot save this nation. President Trump cannot. Only God can. And that is that's a big lesson to take from this. And President Trump is not going to bring world peace from sitting down with Vladimir Putin. Yeah, there can be temporary ceasefires. But as we've seen throughout history, a poor temporary ceasefire can just pave the way for a bigger explosion later on. So if he's going to make a success of this, if he wants to know the way to peace, he has to go to God. And that there are examples of that as well. There's a booklet we have, The Way of Peace Restored Momentarily, that does talk about some world leaders that then got Herbert W. Armstrong involved. And he was involved in negotiating peace and pointed the way to a genuine peace effort. There are practical ways to do it. But if we're not going to God, and if we're not going to God's apostle, if we're not looking to God's man, and we're just figuring things out on our own, it's not going to work. And no matter how well-intentioned, that's where we are right now. I wanted to talk about some of Europe's response to this. I think that's worth getting into. But before we do, I don't know, Jeremiah or Andrew Miller, our U.S. correspondent, if you had any more things you wanted to add.
It's definitely something that we're just watching closely, see how this peace deal unfolds. I know just like on the American domestic front, there's really an appetite for a peace deal here. I looked up the public opinion polls this morning, and they're roughly 50-50 between those who think that we just need to get a peace deal in Ukraine as quickly as possible, opposed to the other 50% who think that America actually has some responsibility to keep supporting Ukraine until they at least reconquer some of the land Russia's taken from them. So President Trump's definitely dealing with that. And I imagine, I didn't look at party breakdown, but I imagine that 50%, that's very much like just get a deal in place in Ukraine, even if you have to surrender territory, and then pull back and focus on some of America's other problems. That probably skews a little more than 50% in the Make America Great Again movement. There's a strong America First strain in that movement that President Trump is dealing with. So just kind of looking at public opinion as a barometer, because it's like we are still a democracy. Our leaders are publicly elected. So you have what's Trump's personal feelings on this, but then there's also like what's the electorate's feelings on this. And it does seem like there is a developing appetite to just pull out of Ukraine, which is prophetically significant. We've talked about for a long time about how Europe and Russia are going to have to come to some sort of deal over Ukraine, because America is not really a major player in Eastern Europe in the end time.
And this is not an easy thing to solve. Like, there's a lot of that position that you just outlined that's very understandable. I mean, you do have this almost delusion, I think, from some in the left, from in Europe, where there's this idea that Ukraine has to win this war, and somehow little Ukraine is going to conquer back all of its territory, and it's going to conquer back Crimea. Like, that's not going to happen. I think it's kind of astonishing that Ukraine is still in the fight, and that Ukraine has held on to as much territory as it has when you compare the resources available to them compared to Russia. They're not taking back Crimea. Like, I just don't think that's going to happen. So yeah, you can understand why people say, well, let's sit down, let's negotiate something and come to an arrangement. But again, the point here isn't, well, there's this very obvious thing that Donald Trump should be doing. The point is that it would take input from God to have a lasting peace and a just, equitable solution to this crisis. But ultimately, it's not God's world. This world as a whole is cut off from God. And God is using these events to wake people up, to bring them to repentance. And these events are going to escalate very, very quickly in order to do that. And one key way that God is going to get the attention of Britain, of America, these other powers, is through this rising power in Europe. And we've covered a lot of how quickly Europe has risen. Europe has had a military turnaround since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I think it was the day that Russia invaded Ukraine, Mr. Flurry had an email that went out that said, most important thing here to watch is Germany. Watch how this transforms Germany. And we've reached the point now where Germany's defense budget has basically doubled from where it was in 2015, and it's projected to rise even more sharply. They've committed to being the biggest conventional military in Europe. They've said we want to overtake France. Well, they've already overtaken France. We want to be Europe's military leader. So that has changed dramatically. But now the peace deal is also being used for Europe to have a big push to boost their military. So in terms, and this is from this security guarantee, because again, Ukraine doesn't want to rely on a piece of paper. They want boots on the ground. And if they can't get American boots on the ground, which seems like they can't, then they want European boots on the ground. In February, Zelensky was talking about 100 to 150,000 troops. And I think that sounds broadly accurate. If you're looking for a force strong enough to defend Ukraine's border with Russia, I mean, it's a border that's 750 miles long, and that doesn't include Ukraine's border with Belarus, that's essentially a Russian puppet. This is a long border to patrol. This is much longer than, say, the North Korea-South Korea border. So if Europe is going to help defend that, we're talking about a massive commitment. I mean, that's twice the size of the entire German army. So that seems a bit of a non-starter. But instead of having, say, a force capable of defending Ukraine's border, they're looking at having a force several thousand strong that would operate as what's called a tripwire. So that if Russia invades Ukraine, they cannot help but end up attacking European forces. And that this, Ukraine would hope, would be then a guarantee that, okay, they've attacked European troops, Europe is now involved in the defense, and they'll be rushing more troops into the front lines, more troops into Ukraine. It's not a cast-iron guarantee, but it's a better guarantee than a piece of paper. That's what they're looking at. And, you know, even this is prompting some soul-searching in Europe. That's expensive. Just maintaining several thousand troops, even on that level, it's expensive. Even on that level, a lot of European countries are kind of like, yeah, we want European troops in Ukraine, just not mine. And that will require some big and some rapid changes in Europe's military. So Russia's invasion of Ukraine prompted big changes. A peace deal looks like that could prompt even more and even faster changes. The other part of this is that something Mr. Flurry has talked about right from the start is that Germany has probably done a deal with Russia. I mean, this, I think, is the only way really to explain Germany's Schulzing, the way that Germany has this appearance of backing Ukraine while not backing Ukraine. In the run-up to that war, you had Britain flying its planes around Germany as they were airlifting in equipment because they didn't really trust Germany. They thought Germany might block the airspace for them. And since then, you've had Germany overpromise, underdeliver. They're always promising big things for Ukraine, and they've deployed that. The reality has generally been much, much less than has promised. Now, I think they are using Ukraine to learn about modern warfare and drone techniques and try out different things. So they have been involved to that extent. But it seems likely they've already agreed that they're going to let Russia have Ukraine. And right in line with that, the German foreign minister immediately announced that Germany probably wouldn't send any troops. And that's not a great look for for Germany's ambitions to be the most kind of dominant European military power. So the Chancellor Friedrich Merz kind of played for time and stepped in saying, well, it's too early to give a definitive answer on that. So I think that explains why you have that situation. But Germany also knows that any deal with Russia, it's always temporary. It always allows them to kind of have some breathing space to focus on other powers, but it always falls apart, and they want to be ready for when that happens. They know that this is not a permanent friendship. And so, yeah, taking advantage of any time that a Russian ceasefire buys to prepare to confront Russia and to build up their own military. And so this is going to be yet another prod for Europe to rapidly expand its capacity to have a military, to deploy a military, to maintain a military beyond its borders. And this is it's a really impressive cover they've got for our latest Trumpet Print article, Printed magazine, but this is the cover for it, Arming for World War III. And they've got planes, tanks, submarines on that cover. The cover article title itself is Germany is Arming for World War III. And in that article, Mr. Flurry writes that Germany is indeed reinventing the nature of warfare. And Bible prophecy reveals it will suddenly start World War III. And he says, right now, we are witnessing Germany begin its final preparations to start this war. There are very rapid preparations going on in Europe. And every bit of, like, war in Ukraine, rapid preparations. Peace in Ukraine, rapid preparations. Whatever it is, they're very quickly building up their armed forces. And this is what God is going to use to correct our nations and get our attention. And a lot of people are going to be caught massively by surprise as this European power unites and ramps up very, very quickly. And so that article, Germany is Arming for World War III, is a great place to go to get more on that. Well, Jeremiah, did you have any other stories from Asia worth paying attention to?
First, a quick one about the Chinese Communist Party having attained a trove of secrets about the U.S. Navy through a former U.S. Navy sailor who sold these secrets to the Chinese. This was a man named Jin Xiaowei, who worked as a machinist on the USS Essex. It's not clear if he was born in the U.S. or not, but in either case, he had a security clearance, and on Wednesday, he was found guilty of 6 separate crimes related to selling these naval secrets to China. And it's good to see him brought to justice, but from what we can tell, the damage was already done. You know, the Chinese no doubt learned a great deal from this stolen information, and this is only the latest instance of China infiltrating and, you know, possibly compromising vital U.S. defense systems. And it shows that as powerful as the American military is, there are major vulnerabilities, and nations like China are actively exploiting these vulnerabilities as they work to paralyze America in the future. And then one final story here about China and India. At this time last year, these two nations were mired in very deep hostilities, with their diplomatic ties just totally disintegrated. That was over a territorial dispute that turned bloody back in 2020, and it left China and India just profoundly mistrustful and bitter toward each other. But over the last few months, we've been witnessing a truly remarkable thaw in China-India ties. They've come to an agreement about their border. India has restored visa services to Chinese tourists. And now just this week, direct flights between China and India have resumed. And China has even begun to lift its curbs on the export of rare earths and fertilizer to India. And then next week, this thaw could hit a whole new level when Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi visits China and has a face-to-face meeting with Xi Jinping there on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. So the reconciliation is happening very quickly. A lot of this is catalyzed by President Trump's pressure on India, which is really driving India away from America and much closer to Russia and China. But this alignment of India with Russia and China, this is exactly what the Trumpet has been expecting for decades, based on Bible prophecy. So it's dramatic to watch it happening. And I'm sure that we'll have more to say on this after Modi makes his visit to China next week.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And I'll just follow up with a few quick European stories as well, where the Balkans has been pretty contentious over the last week or so. You've had Serbian protests, well, going back since November, really, where you had a poorly made roof collapse killing 14 people, and locals blamed government corruption for that. That's led to a series of demonstrations against the president, but they really kicked up this week, where the demonstrators have been, it's been kind of moving more towards riots, but at the same time, the ruling party, the Serbian Progressive Party, it seems like you've had paramilitary groups affiliated with them attacking protesters and this is, you've had a bigger level of violence, with the Deutsche Welle writing, Serbia's streets are beginning to resemble a state of war. The same time, you're having trouble in the Serbian region of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So you have a smaller region there that is majority Serb, but they're not part of Serbia. You know, this is something that is applied across the Balkans, where regions that are majority Croat or majority Albanian, you know, they get to decide their fate and they get to decide what country they're a part of. But if you're majority Serbian, you don't get to decide that you can be part of Serbia. So the Serbs there are understandably upset about that. You have this whole case where Bosnia's courts have declared Republika Srpska, that's the Serbian region, that their president is illegitimate. They've banned him from holding office. He's refusing to step down, and he's instead kind of organizing a referendum in Republika Srpska over his rule. And so, well, it was a German, even a European high commissioner played a major role in getting rid of him. Lots of potential for turmoil in the Balkans. And this is an area that, you know, a lot of outside powers are interested in. You know, it was, like I said, Bosnia's high representative, Christian Schmidt, a member of Angela Merkel's cabinet that played a key role in ousting Dodik. Russia has longstanding ties to the Serbs. I mean, this is an area that's very important to Europe. It's, in a lot of ways, it's Germany's access to the Mediterranean. And it's a crucial crossroads for Europe projecting its power into the Mediterranean. And Russia knows it has a lot of avenues to make trouble for Europe there. So it can very quickly become kind of this proxy conflict. And I think a big part of the reason why Germany is saying, no, we're not going to send troops to Ukraine, is because they're afraid of what Russia might do to them in the Baltic, in the Balkans, sorry. And so they're going to be more restrained. I mean, Germany really did come in and kind of, this was one of their biggest, most aggressive acts after reuniting, was to break up Yugoslavia and establish their influence and control over that region. And that's something we have a lot more on in our little booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans. Another Mediterranean-related story. Pope Leo looks like he's adding a stop to his first overseas trip and could be going to Lebanon. He's already been planning to go to Constantinople, into Turkey, to mark the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. And the head of Lebanon's Maronite Catholic-affiliated church has said in around the same time period he's going to be making a trip to Lebanon. And it looks like he might tag that on as another leg of that trip. So watch for that. Mr. Flurry has talked about Lebanon being a linchpin for Europe's efforts into the Middle East because of Lebanon's Christian population. So this could be a very significant trip if the Pope goes there. He'd be talking about Middle East peace, and he would be talking about the plight of Christians across the Middle East. It would play a major role in Europe building up this alliance that's aligned with them across the Middle East that we forecast for so long. And that we have that in our, Mr. Flurry has more on that, on the rise and fall of Lebanon. And I think another big aspect of the meeting that took place over the weekend with Donald Trump was this kind of European leaders coming and almost bowing before the United States of America. And I'm sure you've seen the pictures. They're all sitting around President Trump's desk. And, you know, they've had a deliberate policy of trying to play nice. And this is something that the European media talks a lot about, and I think something that is pretty chafing to come and have to do. Joshua Michels has an article up on our website, Why European Leaders Bow to Trump. And he talks about this kind of impression in the media. He writes, many, particularly in the German language, have articulated the strategy. Flatter Donald Trump, give him the feeling that he is a great statesman, but continue to despise him. And I think that is absolutely what is happening. He quotes from the German defense minister, Karl-Theodor zu Guttenberg, who, you know, talked about Mark Rutte when he called Donald Trump daddy. And basically, he was kind of saying, yeah, you have to do this. We have to go and show and genuflect before President Trump for now. And, it, you know, if anyone knows what we've talked about on zu Guttenberg's attitude towards Donald Trump, he absolutely despises President Trump. He's not saying, you know, go and call him daddy because he thinks he's a great man. To him, this is a part of using and manipulating President Trump. And I think that's what European leaders are doing. I think they really hate to do it in that fashion. It's humiliating. They don't like it, but they have to do that for now. Mr. Flurry wrote in Germany's astonishing military rise, he was talking about how Jeremiah 40 in verse 30 talks about lovers that despise us. You know, lovers that despise America. That's Europe right now. They act like lovers. They come and they flatter and they sit around Donald Trump's desk and they, you know, they nod and they look impressed or whatever. But they despise President Trump. He said, look at the rhetoric of German leaders today. You see a lot of hatred towards America. Yet we have a romantic idea of Europe and we view Germany as our lovers. What a contrast. Could the Bible have expressed it more to the point? And I think the final story I wanted to mention from Europe ties right in with that, where we've got a more detailed look now at Europe's trade deal with the United States. And we've had more of that published with more of what the fine print is. And basically, it's even worse for Europe than the initial one seemed to be. It's even more of a defeat for them. So one of them is that Europe has said they've promised they're going to recognize America's car standards so that American cars can be imported into the EU without modification to meet European standards. European intelligence wrote, we almost fell off our chair when we read this. This statement reads like a US Commerce Department wish list. And this is something that European leaders have resisted for years. I mean, there's bureaucrats, I think, in both countries are very, very picky about how they apply their rules. I mean, America's like this too. Just if you want to go around a rabbit hole, look at America's view of Kinder Surprise eggs. Like the FDA has this massive, I think it's the FDA, they have this massive effort to try and keep these little chocolate eggs out of the United States because they believe having a toy inside a chocolate egg is fundamentally dangerous. And you can get in a lot of trouble if you try to bring them into the EU. Like these people on both sides of the Atlantic, they're really petty bureaucrats. But European petty bureaucrats really don't like having to go with America's standards and allow that in there. So, I mean, it's a big humiliation for them. I mean, I also think it's just a lot of this is not going to happen. The agreement says that Europe intends to. I think it means they don't intend to. They're just making it, they're trying to put it in there in a way that doesn't actually obligate them to. Similar language on Europe spending $600 billion inside the US, $600 billion from EU businesses. The European Union has no ability to make businesses spend that in the US. The European Union has, I don't think they really have the ability to change car regulation. They have to work with the national government. Like they're promising all of these things to President Trump that they have no ability to do. So the deal is more humiliating than we thought, than we knew, less realistic when we knew. What happens when it becomes obvious that Europe is not going to carry out all of these things that they've promised Donald Trump? And it's going to be still the changing of tariffs, a major hit to the European economy. But then you could have more there, more hits. And I think European intelligence had an excellent point when they wrote, the underlying reality is much worse than one of a badly negotiated deal. What happened is that the US is paying a price for allowing itself to become utterly dependent on the US for its security and for running large and persistent current account surpluses. Yeah, they had this policy of taking advantage of the United States economically while relying on America to pay for its security. And President Trump has realized he has a whole lot of leverage over Europe because of that. And he can stop them taking advantage of America economically and maybe even turn the tables a little by using that security dependence, by threatening to withdraw that, or even just knowing that it's there and having that as a kind of unspoken threat. This is going to be yet another motivation for Europe to rearm. They're really going to chafe at being humiliated like this. So just really watch for that rapid rearmament, just like is on the front cover of that Trumpet magazine. So those are the top stories from Europe. Andrew, we've heard a little from you already, but what was the main story you wanted to cover today from the United States?
I'm still chugging my way through all the new declassified intelligence revelations Tulsi Gabbard is churning out. I think she's the first director of national intelligence America's had in a long time who's really earning her salary. She's had explosive exposés on Obama and John Brennan and James Comey and Adam Schiff. Now she's going after Dr. Anthony Fauci. She said she was going to do this a couple months ago and really just try to get back into some of the cover-ups involving how the COVID-19 pandemic started. And so the Daily Caller actually has an exclusive report now where they talked with some people in the US government, got some inside information on how that's going. That's some really pretty shocking stuff. They found here that they had signal intelligence that the US intercepted between Communist Party officials in Beijing and in Wuhan, basically telling them about 2 months before the pandemic really went global that there was some major crisis had happened in Wuhan. And that signal intelligence was hidden not just from the public, but from the president, who was Donald Trump at the time. This was 2019, Donald Trump's last few months in office before he, or let's say last several months in office before he left in the beginning part of 2021. So I was like really deliberately hiding from the president that there was something going on in Wuhan, which the Daily Caller speculates, like with the election coming up and just a lot of these intelligence agents being part of the deep state, that they were wanting Donald Trump to look as bad as possible coming up with the election. And so by hiding some of this intelligence from him, it really made it look like he was unprepared and wasn't handling the pandemic as well as he could have been if he had been informed from the very beginning that yeah, something happened. They also had they've got quite a few bombshell revelations through here showing that the after Trump left office and Biden came into office, and the investigations going on to COVID were continuing, that they had some genetic sequences there in these classified documents showing that COVID had been genetically engineered. It was the result of splicing together two different species of coronavirus, a bat coronavirus and a mouse coronavirus, for medical research. That they also buried. Because at the time, Dr. Fauci and his inner circle were pushing the wet market theory, the idea that there was a wet market in Wuhan where people were eating different jungle animals, bats and pangolins and other things, and that the virus had mutated to be able to infect humans when it was previously not known. And of course, at the time, there was a theory that it was genetically engineered, and anyone who said that was roundly condemned by the mainstream media as an unhinged conspiracy theorist. Now we're actually going back and getting the receipts showing that actually there was intelligence deliberately excluded from that report, showing that there was evidence that it was engineered, that they wanted to cover up, because I actually read the paper. I'm a biology major myself, so had a little bit of an interest in it. From Dr. Ralph Baric from the University of North Carolina, actually in collaboration with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, on the technique to splice together viruses. Now, that particular paper wasn't a paper on how to make the coronavirus, but it was proof came out before coronavirus was engineered that the US and China were collaborating on gain of function research. In particularly, the University of North Carolina was in collaboration with the Wuhan Institute of Virology on how to splice together viruses. And so when a virus leaked from Wuhan, The idea that it leaked from this giant coronavirus factory should have been the first thing that, the first hypothesis that jumped to people's minds. I think there was one of the comedians in America at the time kind of made an interesting point that he said, he said, if there was a giant chocolate leak, a giant chocolate spill in Hershey, Pennsylvania, he's like, I'm not saying the Hershey chocolate factory did it. But they are suspect number one. Similar here. It's like if there's a giant coronavirus leak near like a level five bio lab in Wuhan, China, that's been doing research in collaboration with the University of North Carolina for years on how to engineer, splice together different species of coronaviruses. I'm not saying they engineered the virus, but they're suspect number one.
Yeah, this was the biggest attack on liberty within Britain and America and a lot of other countries, you know, certainly within modern times. I mean, maybe ever. Like, this was a major attack where governments were saying, you know, you can't go outside your house. You can't have people over to your house. You know, I thought an Englishman's home was his castle. And it just took this coronavirus to do away with that. This was a massive event. It had huge financial consequences. I think it's permanently like Britain's joblessness crisis, the fact that so many people are just staying at home, claiming they're anxious, claiming sickness benefits, that exploded during COVID. I think it's fundamentally changed how we think about freedom, our relationship with the state. Now it's we feel like we've got to get permission from the state for so many more things. This was a cataclysmic event. So going back and looking at how did this happen? How and then uncovering things like you mentioned, where the leak gets out and it's covered up for political reasons because they want President Donald Trump to be unprepared. Like, we need these, it needs to be a massive deal as these things are exposed. And it's completely reasonable, if not just a critical obligation of any government to go back and investigate and expose what happened here. But I mean, there's a lot of, for a lot of people, it's just they don't really want to know. It's not really that, like, we've moved on. We're, you know, COVID, that was 2019's news, and we've moved on from that now. But that kind of attack on liberty, we don't want to move on quickly from.
Right. It is also interesting, too, that I was on January 20th, 2025, so at the very beginning of this year, basically Joe Biden's last act in office, or maybe Joe Biden's auto pen last act in office, was to pardon Dr. Anthony Fauci, a preemptive pardon. And there's even a question as to how legal those are. Of anything he may have done. If you weren't guilty of anything and someone came out and said, it's like, well, just in case you're guilty, I'm going to pardon you. You'd be like, it's like, okay, well, I wasn't sure if he was guilty before, but now I'm kind of suspicious. Why does he need a pardon? That's one reason why there is so much ambiguity over the results of the 2020 election, where Joe Biden allegedly beat Donald Trump, is that they used, because of the COVID lockdown, they used a tremendous amount of mail-in ballots, more mail-in ballots than any election in the US before. Definitely more mail-in ballots than in 20 because so many people were in lockdown. And they, and a lot of those, even at the state attorney general level, maybe even did some illegal things to make it easier to get mail-in ballots because of the excuse of the pandemic. They're like, okay, well, we're not going to go through the right channels to approve these because there's a pandemic. We need these ballots. So I think I've made that point before that if it hadn't been for that COVID pandemic and just that flood of mail-in ballots, and then which Democrats use mail-in ballots to an extent way more than Republicans do, it's like the result of the 2020 election may have been different. It may have been a Donald Trump victory, just because it's like that number of like mail-in ballots just does really favor the Democratic Party, just given like the nuts and bolts of how our elections work. And so the COVID pandemic was kind of the excuse that made that happen. I highlighted in my speaking notes here, Amos 7 verses 1 through 6, which is a kind of a mysterious prophecy that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, explains in America Under Attack, where he talks about at the beginning, like Israel's being invaded by grasshoppers that are just like consuming the plant life. And Amos prays for God to spare the country, and he does. And then it's being consumed by fire, and God, and Amos prays to God to spare the country, and then he does. But when he spares it the second time, he tells Amos that, like, he's like, I'm setting a plumb line to measure the nation, and I'm not going to pass by it anymore, like I did the first two times. And then Mr. Fleury explains in America Under Attack that, like, America being end time Israel, and President Donald Trump being an end time antitype of King Jeroboam, that those first two crises, like the grasshopper plague and the fire plague, are really representative of the first administrations of Barack Obama. First, the actual Obama administration, and then after that, is the puppet administration under Joe Biden. So just showing like the bitter affliction that like the nation's almost wiped out twice. And so that COVID pandemic, which started in Donald Trump's first administration, but really the effects of it took place in the second Biden administration, that definitely does fall very squarely within like the fire part of that verse, that second crisis that God spared Israel from, and then says he's not going to spare it anymore. So just really details on just like you said, this could be like one of the biggest crises in American history and British history, and so which is mentioned as in the Bible as like part of that, not just COVID, but like all the bitter affliction Israel was suffering during the Obama administration, and then later probably even worse during Obama's third term with Joe Biden in the Oval Office. And so God spared America from that. He's giving them a chance to repent. He's not going to spare them again in the same way. And so now really is just the time to like dig into some of these scandals, because I think that like the amount of bitter affliction, I mean, anyone who lived through the COVID pandemic would characterize it as bitter affliction, but just like the amount of complicity on that part of government officials is probably way worse than most people think.
Some really valuable prophetic context. What other stories from the United States this week are worth knowing about?
We got one from a Commonwealth, British Commonwealth nation, just like on a more societal trend. We've got up on the website talking about Australia's drug problem reaching record levels. The nation's war against narcotics is not going well, and in fact, it's pretty much outright failed. And so they did an analysis of wastewater by the National Wastewater Drug and Monitoring Program, concluded that between August 2023 and August 2024, so about a year ago, Australians consumed a staggering 24.5 tons of illegal drugs, which is a 34% increase to the year prior. So that is an enormous one year jump. Just talking about just some of the big societal problems that are affecting not just America, but other English-speaking nations around the world. Also, in America and other English-speaking nations, Open Syllabus, it's an open source platform that just analyzes and catalogs millions of college syllabi across the world, came up with an interesting observation this week that when you're looking at textbooks assigned to college students, Karl Marx is now the fourth most commonly assigned textbook author. The first was Michel Foucault, who's more of a French postmodernist version of leftism, still influenced by Marx. Then William Shakespeare, who actually is, and James Stewart, so a poet and a mathematician who probably deserve to be assigned quite a bit. But yeah, the Foucault, but between the Foucault and the Marx, some cause for concern. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert W. Armstrong, in Mystery of the Ages had a pretty powerful quote at one point where he said that modern education's basically become the agnosticism of Darwin, the politics and economics of Marx, and the morality of Sigmund Freud. And this open syllabi analysis is definitely proving that comment, which was made in the 1980s, very prescient in that you can see that like Marxism, it is the dominant political ideology in the university system today. And then one final story, which I guess kind of relates back to what we originally talked about, is Donald Trump is trying to make good on a campaign promise he made back in 2022 by pushing for same-day voting, voter identification, and paper ballots. He's working with his lawyers. He hasn't signed it yet. He wants to sign an executive order that's doing away with all the mail-in balloting that they used COVID to popularize that really benefited the Democrats in 2020 by just adding a lot of ambiguity as to whether the people who are putting these ballots in ballot boxes are actually citizens or eligible to vote or have only voted once. And then also looking at modifying the voting machines so you have paper ballots. So basically, just looking to make elections in the US more transparent by actually having. You have to go to the poll on election day and cast a paper ballot. So the election officials can see that the paper ballot came from you, and then you can do signature verification and all that to just make sure that only those people who are eligible to vote are voting. And so we'll see how far he gets with that, but it's definitely part of the Saving America temporarily trend, especially given all the information that's being uncovered by Tulsi Gabbard and others on how COVID-19 was used as a pretext to really just flood the nation with mail-in ballots, that there's a lot of question marks concerning.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Israeli troops began their long-awaited invasion of Gaza City this week. To give us the latest on that and on ceasefire talks, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zeki.
Yeah, so Israel started attacking the perimeters of Gaza City on August 20th with the intention to expand and take over the entirety of the area. It's one of the last bits of territory that is not under IDF control right now, and once that's consolidated, there isn't much left for the IDF to mop up and have complete control of Gaza. The Israeli government has called up 60,000 reservists to help in the effort. According to the current government statements, the idea is not to fully implement an occupation of Gaza, but to establish a security perimeter, dismantle Hamas, and secure the hostage releases. It's not only Israel that's scrambling for this. Egypt has called 40,000 reservists to militarize the North Sinai in violation of their own peace treaty with Israel. One Israel or Egyptian security source told Middle Eastern Eye this that, quote, "Egypt's army is on the highest state of alert we've seen in years," end quote. Israel has already invaded Gaza City twice, but with everything surrounding this current invasion, looks like everybody's anticipating this to be a lot more large scale and game-changing than the previous ones.
That like is Israel's intention to now completely take over Gaza, dismantle Hamas, free the hostages that way? Or is this more of a bargaining posture? And because they're still negotiating over a ceasefire, is this something about trying to get a better deal from Hamas?
Well, they say it's to do the first option that you mentioned, but they've been saying that for a long time. As you mentioned, there are hostage negotiations going on right now, and Hamas has reportedly accepted an Israeli proposition that they suggested a month ago, and Hamas originally rejected. Israel has yet to respond. But Israel is under quite heavy pressure from the domestic front to get a hostage deal going. An August 8th poll by Mariv suggests 57% of Israelis would accept a deal where Hamas releases all the hostages in exchange for ending the war. Mariv is a quite on the left-leaning side of the Israeli political spectrum, so that may not be an accurate representation of Israeli society as a whole. There could be a massive casualty rate among Israeli soldiers that put the number of hostages killed makes it pale in comparison.
So we've had Benjamin Netanyahu on the cover of not the most recent, but the one before that, Trumpet print edition, as Israel's rising lion, really, I think, you know, extolling him and drawing some lessons from his boldness in confronting evil. And you know, here, I think you see he does have a lot of determination, a lot of resolve. The nation as a whole, not as much. And so, I mean, he does still have definitely supporters. There are definitely people that are right behind him, and maybe they have differences politically with him, but they support dealing with Hamas. And I think there's a lot of people that see the danger in leaving this organization intact, because you will just have another October 7th. But I think the fact that you do have a lot of people wanting to compromise with Hamas, wanting to, I mean, you can sympathize with people wanting the hostages back, especially family members. That's a very natural impulse. But the reluctance to fight Hamas, that Benjamin Netanyahu almost has an uphill battle to bring the nation with him in defeating evil, does show a certain sickness within Israel. I think it's a sickness that is less developed there than it is in Britain and America, where very clearly our wheel is much more broken. And you do have a strong leader in Israel that certainly in Britain, we don't have a leader with that kind of courage. But this does come back to a spiritual issue. And this is a point that Mr. Flurry made in A Key of David earlier this year, that Israel used to have the faith in God to step up and confront evil. And God worked incredible miracles in 1948, in the Six-Day War in 1967. And those miracle victories have ceased. And here's what he had to say about that.
What God is telling them here is that the real problem is spiritual. The wound is spiritual. They had a lot of faith when they were given this nation. They had quite a lot of faith at that time, certainly more than what they have now. I think most people would agree with that. But here you have the Jews keep trying to solve the problem by making some kind of a peace pact. Now, we'll see what happens in this latest war. They say they're going to wipe out Hamas, but well, at least in Gaza, they're going to, and that's, when you think about it, there was a time when the little nation of Israel was just an absolute terror to the Arabs, and now it's just reverse, totally different. What happened? Well, they've been trying to make peace pacts, but that's not the way to deal with a problem like this, according to the Bible, their own Bible, the Jewish Bible.
And I think Benjamin Netanyahu sees that. You know, he sees that peace pacts won't deal with the problem, and he does have the confidence and the boldness to step up. But he is one man, and Israel is a democracy, and if the rest of the nation doesn't follow with that, there's only so much that this one man can do. And perhaps that is the question that the future of Gaza, the future of this problem will hinge around.
And I think Mr. Netanyahu knows that he's not going to be around forever. Say, for example, he does go into Gaza, guns blazing, and wipe out Hamas. If the casualty rate among the soldiers is so high enough that maybe they say there's a vote of no confidence triggered about him. He's in a very precarious position in the Knesset right now. And then there's political chaos, and then whoever comes in and says, okay, we've had enough of the bloodshed, let's just stop and unilaterally move out. That would ultimately cause a lot of problems for Israel down the road too. He doesn't really have many good options to move forward.
And he's constrained by those home front constraints. He's also constrained by international opinion. And there was a survey this week that showed 6 in 10 Americans believe Israel's military response in Gaza is excessive. 58% believe that that every country in the UN should recognize a state of Palestine. I mean, this shows that same spiritual sickness that we were talking about infecting the United States. This is comparable to wanting to make peace with Adolf Hitler in 1943, 1944, and doing that would be a reflection of a broken will. These kind of results are also a reflection of a broken will. But that's another, that Benjamin Netanyahu has to balance that too.
But it's interesting on the war of words he's been having with some of these world leaders, like the local prime minister here, Sir Keir Starmer, how Mr. Netanyahu said that if somebody came and killed 12,000 Brits and then went across the border, like, you don't think Britain would be standing idly by and letting that happen. But you think about, say, the peace process with Northern Ireland and how a lot of IRA terrorists got amnesty, and there's been these wranglings that are pulling Northern Ireland closer and closer to the EU at the expense of British sovereignty. Obviously, it's not on the same scale, but at the same time, you can still see that policy of appeasement and just surrendering, even in the British government right now, and all these nations in the English-speaking world, whatever mindset, whatever fraction or residue of that you see in Israel, the state of Israel, to confront evil and to recognize evil when you see it, that's gone in the other countries now.
And that's a powerful and urgent warning to the English-speaking world, that we do live in a dangerous world. I mean, October 7th should have been a wake-up call to all of us. We like to think that we're all very sophisticated and evolved, and the kind of barbarous things that you read about in a history book are confined to the history book, because we are so much, human nature has improved. We've got education and higher education, and we've got things like the United Nations and the European Union, and we haven't had a major global conflict for 80 years now. And that's because we're just so much better and better people. And October 7th should have been a wake-up call to everyone that complacent worldview is fundamentally false, and that there is real evil out there, and that there are people that will confront these inhuman attacks. And we need to be able to stand up strongly to that. And if not, those attackers will be victorious. And this has exposed a massive level of weakness in the face of that in Britain, in the United States, even in Israel, with those that aren't kind of behind Netanyahu and what he's doing. And I mean, this was the point that Mr. Flurry made right after October 7th. I mean, his first article, I think, at least the first Trumpet print edition after that, was called A Sign of Worse to Come. And he said, this is important to realize. Otherwise, you will not grasp the significance of what happened in the Jewish state of Israel. This nightmare is a foreshadowing and a sign of a time of unprecedented suffering prophesied to come upon the whole world very soon. And this is just a small preview of similar attacks coming worldwide. And it shows we don't have the strength to deal with them. And we lack that strength because of sin. It's a spiritual sickness, as Mr. Flurry said in that Key of David. And our nations are all sick. And what we need is repentance. We need an urgent turning to God. That's the only way to save our nations. It's the only way for individuals, for you, to save yourself from what is coming. So that, I think, is the urgent warning behind the sickness that we see there in Gaza. Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. On that somewhat sobering note, do you have any other stories from the Middle East worth paying attention to?
A couple. Today, the foreign ministers of the UK, France, and Germany are due to speak with Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister of Iran, about snapback sanctions. The three countries rewind back to the Obama era nuclear deal. They have the power to bring back all these United Nations and force sanctions on Iran and cripple the economy if they find Iran non-compliant with the original deal. That expires in October, but they've been threatening for months now to do just that while they still can. Again, they've been threatening it for months and they still haven't followed through, so we'll see what happens. But the fact that they keep bringing it up over and over again, and that the deadline is coming up soon, may suggest that something could happen on that. And also on Wednesday, Israel approved the construction of a settlement near Jerusalem that Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said would bury the idea of a Palestinian state. This is particular settlement has been on hold for about 20 years from pressure from the U.S. government, but now you're seeing them go full steam ahead with that. And the recent spate of countries recognizing the Palestinian state has a lot to do with that, I'm sure. In one sense, Israel has been constructing new settlements for a while now, but the rhetoric and purpose behind that shows that the West Bank may become a flashpoint for the world's focus very soon.
Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Well, that is about all that we've got time for. I will just draw attention once again to our latest Trumpet print magazine that has our most thoughtful, the articles we've spent the most time with, really polishing up, and that's going to give you the most in-depth Bible explanation for world events. And that latest Trumpet print has the cover Arming for World War III. Just bang up to date with what we've had from Europe this past week. You can read that online at our website, thetrumpet.com. You can also order your own free subscription. We'd be very happy to send it out to you. It comes out 10 times a year, and that's it. You know, it's not a free gift while we then try and sell you other things or pass your data on to other people. We just send you the magazine, and every 6 months or so, or every year, we just check that you want to keep receiving that magazine. And it's always free. It's not a free trial or anything like that. So we'd be very happy to give that to you, and you can get our best content delivered right through your door. We'll have links to that and all the other articles in our show notes. Thank you to all of our panelists today. Thank you to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. You can like, subscribe, follow on YouTube, on Rumble. You can get us on our website, thetrumpet.com as well, over the air on KPCG 101.3 FM in the Edmond, Oklahoma area. Thank you very much for joining us once again. We'll be back on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.